Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Well, welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival morning panel. No happy endings, no easy answers. Seeking truth through trauma. I think that says a lot and it all. Before we get started, just a reminder to folks to silence their cell phones or turn off their cell phones. That would be really awesome. We'll kind of do like these amazing authors sharing for a bit, questions that that I have for them, and then we'll have about 15, 20 minutes to see if there's questions in the audience for the panel. Just a minute about myself. My name is Sonia Shah. I'm local. I teach at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and I also run a nonprofit called the Ahimsa Collective, and which is based in the principles of restorative justice. And we have these three incredible, amazing people here today. Kiese, Devi, and Lacey, who have all just written these phenomenal books that you've probably already read, really kind of working through trauma, violence, misogyny, racism, not being able to lie, only being able to tell the truth, and working through sort of trauma that is not just like theoretical trauma, but actually their own, and kind of writing their way through it, as you probably also read. So we're going to start this panel with each of your beautiful authors reading or speaking the context of their book for 5 minutes each, and then we have a couple questions. And so I'm just going to turn it over to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is this on? All right, how y'all doing today? I'm smiling because we're about to talk about some things that might not make us smile. I really don't have too much to say about this book, other than it was hard to write. And I feel like I want to say before I do any sort of reading is that I think when you write a book like this, some people can valorize you as a truth teller. And what I want folks to know is that is not who I am. That's who I aspire to be. And I think there's a big difference. I think the book gave me an opportunity to try, not to tell the truth, but to honestly reckon with things that I wanted to hide from. And that, sadly, in this culture, does not mean that I was telling the truth. And I also just want to say something else about the book, now that the book has been out for a while, and that the trauma, the word trauma doesn't appear in the book, but the trauma that I'm trying to honestly reckon with is not just trauma that was directed at me because of my mother. I'm not lucky enough to live in a world where if my mom did bad things to me, that's the only reason that I would have to deal with trauma. Every sort of ism in the world, mass incarceration, mass evictions, I think all contributed to a lot of the traumatic things in my life. But I also want to talk about humor and comedy and how humor and comedy are not separate for me from trauma. And I just want to say I'm really thankful that the book is done. And this is and this is my next to last book event, and I'm really happy that I don't have to talk about the book for a little while. So I'm just going to read maybe two or three paragraphs. Are we doing it like that? Are we going to just read?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We're just going to read like two or three paragraphs, and then hopefully we can get on with this conversation. So thank y'all.
Tell us the name of your book.
Yeah, my book is Heavy, an American Memoir. Thank you. All right. My body knew I would make appointments for the procedure and therapy, but skip both of them. My body knew I would gorge it for weeks until I was 206 pounds and feel heavier at 206 than I felt at 319. At 206, it knew that I would cancel everything I was supposed to show up to on campus except for class. When I showed up, my colleagues and students would ask me if I was okay. My body would remember when I had 3% body fat, ran 13 miles a day, ate vegan, had lots of visible veins, and fainted a lot. It would remember taking off my shirt and shoes in the weight room to weigh myself surrounded by thin women people secretly called anorexic. It would remember never worrying about anyone ever calling me anorexic, though I was the first one at the gym at 6 a.m. and the last one to leave at 10. Like nearly everyone else in the gym, I wasn't in the gym to be healthy. I was in the gym to feel in control of how fat I looked and felt. My body knew that my weight, the exact number, became an emotional, psychological, and spiritual destination a long time ago. I knew and worried about how much I weighed and exactly how much money I had every day of my life since I was 11 years old. The weight reminded me of how much I'd eaten, how much I'd starved, how much I'd exercised, how much I sat still yesterday. My body knew I was no more liberated or free when I was 159 pounds with 2% body fat than I was at 319 pounds with achy joints. I loved the rush of pushing my body beyond places it never wanted to go, but I was addicted to controlling the number on that scale. Controlling the number on the scale more than writing a story or an essay or feeling loved or making money or having sex made me feel less gross and most abundant. Losing weight helped me forget. When I weighed over 200 pounds again, I would not touch my body. I would not want anyone else to touch my body. I would not believe anyone who knew me when I was 159 pounds could love me or want to touch me when I was over 200 pounds. As the number continued to climb, I would teach and I would write and I would revise and I would avoid you and grandmama. I would continue to lie to the one person in the world who did everything she could to make sure I was healthy. I would learn 15 years too late that asking for consent, granting consent, surviving sexual violence, being called a good dude, and never initiating sexual relationships did not incubate me from being emotionally abusive. Consent meant little to nothing if it was not fully informed. What and to whom were my partners consenting if I spent our entire relationships convincing them that a circle was not a circle, but just a really relaxed square? I'd become good at losing weight and great at convincing women they didn't see or know what they absolutely saw and knew. Lying there on that floor, I accepted that I'd actually never been honest in any relationship in my life, and I'd never been honest with myself about what carrying decades of lies did to other people's hearts, heads, and bodies.
Hi, can you hear me? Okay. So that was amazing. It's really hard to follow. So I just want to say that I am a 52-year-old debut novelist. Thank you. So one thing I always do when I'm up on stage is I take a picture of you. Because I had no expectation when this book came out that anybody besides my husband would show up at these things. Smile. So I'll tell you a little bit about Atlas. I started this as a short story. I'd been accepted to a workshop in 2004, and I wrote this family story based on the book that I hold very dear to my heart as the gold standard of poets who write novels is The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. So what Sandra did was she put all these beautiful pieces together, and together they made a novel. And yet, each of the pieces in the book are heavily anthologized as poetry. And I really love the short chapters, and I love the poetic language, and I really strive to write something like that. So I wrote a 5,000-word short story, and then I took it to Squaw Valley, and then it was pretty well received, and then I kept working on it. And then, unfortunately, in May of 2010, nine years ago this month, my husband was racially targeted by his former employer in Georgia, and they raided my house. The state police raided my house at gunpoint. And so it is, a literary conceit to have a life flashing before your eyes narrative, but it is also somewhat true that when a policeman is holding his, pointing his AR-15 at you, that you do tend to think about what's important and what's relevant, and I did that. And when I was finally able to return to this story, because I lost most of my work on that day and I have not gotten it back, it took me 4 years to come back to this book, and then I had to restart it and rethink it, and I too use humor, you know, because you can't cry about everything. Got to laugh some of it off. And, you know, I wanted to really look through the family story again, but through a different lens. And I felt like everyone in the world goes through something difficult in their lives, whether or not it rises to the occasion of the evening news. And I felt like the raid then became the contextual glue for this book. So I'm just going to read a paragraph. One sec. Here we go. She closes her eyes and a kaleidoscope appears, the blue of the sky giving way to the red pulse of pain near her stomach. She opens her eyes and the sky is a clean slate now. The little wisps of cloud are all but gone. The sky is the color of her alma mater. She thinks of the bumper sticker she put on her first car when she was exactly half the age she is today. If God isn't a Tar Heel, then why is the sky Carolina blue? The pain is less when she doesn't give in to the light show, but the light show is hard to ignore. Every time she opens or closes her eyes, the blues and blood reds are reinvented. She is witnessing the continents shifting, the tectonic plates of years shifting and crashing into each other. She spies the steeple of a neighbor's pine tree at the bottom corner of her line of sight. The owl is no longer hooting, and the neighbor with a lawnmower starts his engine. The shadow of the policeman crosses her face, and she closes her eyes, shutting them tightly as if she would never open them at all. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
I don't think. Oh, there it is. Hello. So I'm Lacey Johnson. I'm going to talk a little bit about the book The Reckonings, which is a book of essays, which in many ways is a follow-up to the previous book, which is a memoir called The Other Side. And in The Other Side, I write about this time that I got kidnapped and raped by a man that I had been in an abusive relationship with but had escaped. And that happened in 2000, but it took me many, many years to write about it and to figure out how to write about it. And to be clear, he got away. He's still a fugitive living in Venezuela to this day. And when I was touring for The Other Side or giving readings from it, and we got to the question and answer, or sometimes question and comment, portion, there would be inevitably somebody would ask the question about what do you want to have happen to this person who did this to you? You probably want him dead, right? And that question struck me as so odd. And not only odd, but I just kept getting it. And so many people kept assuming that I would want this person killed, this person who I had loved and who did a terrible thing. But to want him dead implied that I would have to hate him. But that it was just so consistently what people wanted for me. And also, that just got me thinking, I guess, about how we define justice in this country, or the entrenched, you know, institutional definition of justice, which is you do something bad happens to you, and therefore justice. And of course, that's an extremely old, you know, definition of justice. It's not just Old Testament, the eye for an eye. It's goes back to the Code of Hammurabi, which is the very first set of written laws. You know, it's 5,000 years old. And so then I was wondering, like, what is it about our contemporary society that compels us to cleave to these ancient, barbaric, in some ways, ideas about what justice should be? Can't people see that this book that I have written is, for me, an act of justice? So that question, I guess, compelled me into this book, into The Reckonings, where I wanted to just think about what that means. What does justice mean to us? And especially in situations where it is not clear-cut, where there isn't necessarily a single person that you can hold accountable and send to jail. I'm thinking about broad societal wrongs and institutional wrongs and historical injustices. You know, how does it work in that situation when there isn't this easy symmetry? And I guess the conclusion that I come to is that if, you know, we're sort of in love with the idea of, you know, the symmetry of an eye for an eye, you do something bad happens to you. Like, can we think of it in terms of a different symmetry, which is if you extract justice from, or joy from this world, that you should have to give it back, that you should promote joy in the world rather than continue to promote more suffering. So it took me, 12 essays, I think, to get to that conclusion. And I'm just going to read a tiny little bit, I guess, of the first essay, which is called, it's the title essay, it's called The Reckonings. And unfortunately, these are very long essays, and they're not easily excerpted, but I'll give my best shot. So just to set this up, where do I want to go? Okay, I'm actually going to start over here. So I'm writing about the question that I get asked, and how within this question that I get asked, and the person who asks the question always has their own stuff, right, that they're asking for. And they also, like, when they come up to me during the, you know, period when I'm supposed to be signing books, they say, you know, like, I have a story that's similar to yours in certain ways. And it strikes me that there's, you know, so many people who have a story like mine. You know, I always thought for a really long time, because of shame and everything like that compelled me to keep silent about it, that I was the only person that anything like that had ever happened to you. But of course, it's much more common than we think. But, you know, people tell me these stories. So I say, I carry these stories with me because I don't know what else to do with them. The details may differ. If it is not the story of an abusive lover, perhaps it is a mother or a father or an uncle. Or it is a story of a friend who has been killed by a stranger while trying to do the right thing. Or a woman who was shot in the back of the head while asking for help. It might be a story about the abuse of power or authority, of the slow violence of bureaucracy, of the way some people are born immune from punishment and others spend whole lifetimes being punished in ways they did nothing to deserve. In my story, there was a man I once loved very much. And because of the self-destructive way in which I loved him, I didn't want to leave him when he abused me first with his words and then with his fists. I told myself I could fix him, that this wasn't who he was, not really. I let him keep showing me who he really was until I finally believed him and left. I had already lived a few lies by that time, I thought. A farm girl from Missouri, a door-to-door steak salesperson, a sex worker, a model from New York, and model in New York, a survivor of domestic violence and sexual assault. But I was afraid none of these lives had sufficiently prepared me to live the one I wanted more than anything else. I had only just begun thinking of myself as a writer around that time, but I told myself I had probably not read enough books, had not visited enough continents, was not smart enough or wise enough, didn't have anything to say, and no one would want to hear it if I did. I thought there had been a mistake in the cosmic register. Somewhere there was another Lacey Johnson who could keep straight when to use lay instead of lie, who actually belonged in all the places I began finding myself. Who deserved all the good things that suddenly seemed to be happening to me. This is all to say that the worst violence that man committed was not against my body, but against the story I told about the person I believed myself to be. I was 21 when that man kidnapped and raped me and tried but failed to kill me. The man got away, and I got away. He is a fugitive living in Venezuela, and I am a writer of books. The last one I wrote was about him, about the day he meant to kill me, but I lived. It was not easy, not the writing, and not the living. Not until I often found myself standing in front of strangers, telling them there is justice for me in standing here in this room, alive and breathing and telling my own story with my own voice. It is not the ending to the story anyone expects, not even the one they want, because they want a return, a redemption, a retrieval of all I had lost for my part in the story. They want suffering for him. They want blood, guts, gore. Now that would be justice, they think.
Thank you. It's just so nice to hear your voices come into the room as a way to start. So, you know, I have a couple questions, I guess. So the thing about trauma, right, is that whether it's structural trauma from racism or patriarchy or whether it's interpersonal trauma, is that it arrests us. Unprocessed trauma can lead us to, like, have our memories not come back, to act out and harm others, to act in and harm ourselves. And I guess I just want to ask about your process of working through trauma and writing through trauma. And just sort of, what does it mean to try to write in a way that is so vulnerable? And I appreciate what you said about not necessarily being labeled as a truth teller, but as someone who is trying not to hide anymore from the things that were there. So I hope that's, like, it's probably my roundabout question. Yeah?
Oh.
There's a mic.
Okay. That's a great question. So I just want to start by saying that my process was not healthy. And I think that question, when I hear that question, it sounds like I want to be able to be like, this is what I did. But, you know, like, what I did in the writing of this book was really not healthy. Like, I don't have any children. I live by myself. I have a diligent writing practice. And I tried to write every morning for 2 hours and 2 hours before I went to bed, into memories that I was trying to evade, and not like happy memories, right? Like memories that I was, that I spent my lifetime sort of trying to stiff arm. And they weren't just memories about sexual violence. They weren't just memories of, you know, being destroyed at home. They were memories of, you know, cops saying I threw crack out of a window when I didn't fucking throw crack out of a window. And it took 3 years of writing this book, writing into what people call trauma, for me to realize that, like, I was deteriorating my body, my imagination, my friendships, everything. Because I thought that the way to confront this shit was to write directly into it and not think about, like, the artistry of what we call trauma. And the book, for me, started to come alive when I wrote this chapter in the book called Black Abundance, which is, to me, the most important section in the book, where, yes, I'm writing about what it meant the first time we went to school with white folks and the fucked up things that the teachers did to us and the ways our parents started to discipline our bodies differently. Like, when I went to school with white people, instead of beating me on my arms or my, you know, visible spaces, my mama started to whip me in places where the white folks couldn't see. And while she was whipping me, she would talk to me about how white folks were going to do whatever she was doing, white folks were going to do doubly, right? So that existed. But on the flip side of that existed, you know, the verbal games my friends and I would play to make ourselves feel bodily, like, present in these white schools. And that shit made me happy. You know what I mean? So it took 3 years of writing the book to accept, not to find, to accept that for me, there was joy, not just in the creases of the trauma, but, like, in the trauma. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so it's sad that it took me that long, because I was teaching writing, you know, and I was teaching my kids, you got to write every day and you got to write the hard shit, you know, so I was fucking them up while I was fucking myself up. But for me, the process, the book came alive when I accepted that in addition to, like, wholly destructive things that happened, that I did, that happened to me too, there were just, like, absolutely sublime, abundant, super black shit that really, really, really kept me alive. And the book is as much a chronicling of that as it is a chronicling of the catastrophe.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we're good.
Okay. So, I really wanted to write, the book is not me, it's not, the narrator is not me. I did give her some autobiographical things, such as my dog, Greta was real. But I did that because, Grace Paley once said that you're not actually supposed to write about what you know. You're supposed to write about what you don't know about what you know. And so I had to start from a place of familiarity, and so I gave her a few of my things, and I explored the unknown with that. And I really was trying, I used to be a reporter. I used to be a crime reporter, a crime and government reporter, which these days is the same thing. And... and then, but so I really wanted to, when I first started writing this story in 2004, I was really interested in facts, and I was very accurate. I was like, it happened on this day at this time and with these people. And then when I came back to it in 2014, I was very disinterested in when it happened and who it was. And it wasn't a memoir, it was a story. And so I sort of let go of all of the facts, and I just really, really tried to just tell what's the truth of this moment. And the truth for me of this book is that it's an accumulation. It's not just one thing. It's 10,000 things. And some of them are the same beats, and so I had to take everything out that repeated, right? And I just wanted to present this picture of this is a musical score of America and how people of color in America are treated sometimes, and I just wanted to do that. The other thing is, people say or have said, especially lately, like, oh, it must have been so cathartic for you to write this book. And I deny the catharsis, I don't think it was, I don't feel better. I really changed as a result of the raid and all the things that happened for the next 6.5 years until, a judge dismissed all of this stuff. But I changed as a writer. I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to show the kind of writer I've become, but I'm still changing. And so this is a snapshot of who I was at the end of 2016, but that's when the book was finished, but it's not who I am today. So
in this book, I'm not... I guess I wrote about my own trauma more in the previous book, and in this book, I'm thinking about it, and thinking about, like, not just the trauma itself, but, like, how do we, because I hate all this language about, like, recovery and putting the pieces back together again after you've been shattered and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm a whole person. Like, I've always been a whole person. It's just I'm a different person now from, I'm changed, after this experience. And so it's not, like, how do I put myself back together again? But how do I move in broken ways, in ways that don't make more breakage for others? And so, in this book, I'm thinking about that, transformation and discovery that can occur when you try to move into the future. I also think my process is really, really, really not healthy, and I don't recommend it at all. But, I guess I start by sort of thinking about what are the sort of forms of harm that I feel like my voice can be of value, because I don't think my voice is the most valuable one in every conversation, but there are some maybe when I feel like I do have something that I could say. And also with thinking about, sometimes that has to do with my role in being a person who's causing harm. It's not just like all, I'm the receptacle and it's all on my body, but because, being a traumatized or harmed person doesn't mean I haven't harmed others. And so thinking about what are the what's the harm that I'm interested in, but being really conscious not to sort of like make a spectacle of that, especially paying attention to like whose bodies and, you know, the violence on whose bodies is always made a spectacle. But sort of thinking about starting from this place, okay, so this terrible thing has occurred, and instead of looking at the violence itself, I try to look at like who's doing it, like look out of the frame of the photograph that we normally see of, you know, the violence itself, and try to see who's missing from the frame and who's causing it, and thinking about, you know, what, you know, I write about all kinds of violence, racial violence, sexual violence, ecological violence, and, you know, in the case of something like the BP oil spill, which is an essay, you know, that I have here, is like what, so, you know, the oil spill is the violence itself, but like how do we trace that up the chain of causality or permissibility to see like where did that company get permission to do that? Because, you know, every act of violence, the person committing it thinks that their circumstances excuse them or make it okay. So where did they get that permission from? Like, where did the man who abused me get his permission from? You know, because we might call him a monster, but everything about our culture tells him that that's okay, right? That he had never been told that it wasn't. And so as I'm sort of sitting with that, you know, that work of kind of chasing it up the chain of causality, the metaphor I like to think of is actually of not going up a ladder, but actually down in a hole and sort of digging and digging and digging and trying to find the sort of the bottom of it to see like how all these pieces are connected. And once I get down there, I'm in this dark, terrible, awful hole looking at like this really ugly truth. And I look around and I'm all alone in this dark, terrible hole with this awful truth. And it's like, holy shit, how'd I get here? What am I gonna do? And then the writing is the ladder that I build to climb my way out. So you can see how this is not a good process to do to yourself 12 times, like over the course of several years, to like go into this really ugly place. I don't recommend it. However, that was just sort of what it took, I guess, to get there.
Thank you. You know, it's funny because I think a lot of times people don't think that, you know, trauma, dealing with trauma is really about wellness and resiliency in the end, right? It's about becoming whole and well and forget that the other side is this place of deep resiliency. So kind of going to the resiliency end of the spectrum, it feels like there's this theme that runs through your pieces, your books, your works about liberation and being free and getting free. Feels like it runs throughout your book, even as you mentioned the Black Abundance, you know, writing to your people, what does it mean to get free? I feel like the passage you read, Lacey, even just that in itself, there's something in voice and liberation, and maybe introducing yourself as a 52-year-old novelist, like, hey, I'm here. So I'm asking you, like, so what's your journey to liberation like? You know, what lets you get free? How's that going? Like, what's the state of your liberation, folks? And like, you know, what's that like? And then what makes you put the mask back on? And what allows you to get free?
Okay. Let's try this. Can you hear me? Okay, great. So when I came home on May 17th, 2010, and there were police at my door, and there were police on my driveway, and one of them pointed his weapon at me, and among the things they confiscated from my house that day was my computer. So as you can imagine, I lost most of my work, and so for the next year, I didn't write very much because I was busy corralling my family. So then in June of 2011, I sat down to write, and I could not. I found that I could not. And so I was very upset. I didn't know how I was gonna be a writer if I couldn't write. And I had a really good friend in Atlanta who made me go watch Julie and Julia. Have any of you seen that movie? Yeah.
So for those of you who haven't, it's the true life story of Julie Powell, and she gave herself a task. She was going to cook her way through Julia Child's cookbook within a year. So she had to do all the recipes within a year. And so I am a photographer, and my friend said, you can do that. You can title your photographs and you can post them online and hold yourself accountable to those of us who follow you on social media, and your words will come back. And she was right. So it took me a year of posting them, and I started on June 23rd, 2011, and I do it to this day. And that's how I'm free, because every day I take the 2 minutes to take a photo, whatever it is, and I post it and I caption it. And my poetry came back after a year, and then the prose came back after 3 years. And that's how I'm free. It's those 2 minutes. And so, there are a lot of writers, and everyone has their own process, and I'm not dissing anyone else's, but I know that as a writing practice, that's the thing that's keeping me free, is that I get to do as I wish, and no one is telling me that I can't, or they're not taking away my things, and so I feel like, everyone here has an opportunity to do as they wish. It's great to have a writing practice of 2 hours, or I'd love to do that too. There are some days I get to do that, but some days I have 5 minutes. Yeah. So I make the best of those 5 minutes, and that's how I'm free. Yeah.
So I'm actually going to read a tiny little paragraph here. And this is from actually the last essay, called Make Way for Joy. Someone once told me that his grandmother told him that an injustice is anything that gets between a person and their joy. I don't know if that covers all of what an injustice is, but I like the idea that justice is anything that makes way for joy, that makes the condition of joy a possibility again. So in thinking about not just how I get free, but how we make we promote our mutual and collective joy, I think to me is the sort of conclusion that I came to, that it's not that is what justice looks like, is the sort of is working together for our mutual joy, for not just my own personal, liberation, and for me that looks like being, it's kind of very mundane and silly, but it looks like being able to run by myself in the dark sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like, it sounds like such a mundane thing, but to be a woman in this world is to often be afraid and to fear the violence of men. And to be able to just feel the strength of my body, to feel my body carrying me through this world. And I like to run in the early morning when it's dark, and I see the sun coming up, and it's so beautiful. And the thing that, courses through my veins is joy. Mm-hmm. And that feeling then prepares me to sort of enter the fray of the injustices of the world. Not only that, but also then to be present in my life, with my children. I mean, one of the longest and most enduring symptoms, I guess, or traumas from having been kidnapped and raped by this person is that it's really hard for me to be present in any given moment. I'm always I'm always so vigilant and thinking and sort of catastrophizing and imagining, what could possibly go wrong in this here? Or if I'm not thinking about what could happen in the future, I'm remembering what has happened in the past. And this moment of just being able to be present right then in my body does help me be present with my children when they're on the floor and they're playing and they're laughing, and I can just be right there with them laughing, even if it's only 10 seconds long. Like that space where joy can enter my life, it feels like justice. And I don't need anything bad to happen to him for that to be possible at all.
Yes.
Thank you for all of these easy questions.
Oh yeah, that's the point. That's the point.
So
you wrote about this,
right?
So.
Right. That's true. I'll be really brief. So part of liberatory practice for me means that I have to accept that I'm not here in front of y'all. In California because I wrote a great book or a good book or a decent book. I know that I'm here primarily because groups of black, southern, rural folks strategized, organized, and committed to direct action. And so part of liberation for me means I don't have to just accept that as like this blob of victory. It means I need to trouble that, right? And I need to accept that as valiant and strong and all of these words we use to describe the people who made me, I think one of the things that the people who made me weren't really good at was tenderly and compassionately and honestly loving each other, right? Like I come from folk for whom it is easier to organize than it is to tenderly and compassionately love one another. And I think sometimes we trip those things up. I think we think like tender, compassionate treatment of each other is organization. In Mississippi, so many of our like successful organizing efforts have been led by very charismatic men who are very harmful to themselves, to other men, and particularly to femmes and genderqueer folk, right? So for me, if there is liberation, it's in troubling like the basis of why I am anywhere in the world, and that has sometimes so little to do with the actual art. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the people who made me, and also I want to do the best of what they did, but I also want to be a little bit more attuned to the creases of the relationships, because I think that is as important as an organizer, but it's not either or. Do you know what I mean? And I think at my worst, and I think I am at my worst every day, I can sit up in front of people and give a speech about whatever the fuck, but it's just hard to be like tender and kind and compassionate to the people I purport to love. And that's the hardest thing. Like, and it's hard too when you got light shining in your face and people think that because the light is shining in your face, you have reached this point. But every day I just think it's hard to be a tender, compassionate, loving person, not just to like people you sort of know, but to the people you really love. And that's a goal, but for me, like for it to be achieved, I have to accept when I fail at it. Yeah.
Thank you. Wow. So powerful. I think we could pretty much ask ourselves what we do to get free every day. And I'm sure something about being in this room has something to do with it. Just one more like kind of hard question. And then I just deal with like a lot of severe trauma and violence and folks every day. So that's like my world. Yeah. And also placing yourself in tradition and history and why. And I think this speaks to like, you know, when you're talking about sexual violence and you're talking about racism, there's a way that all three of you kind of talk about like normalization of violence in the everyday. Like, it's just what happens. You know, it's like, I don't know, some folks that I work with, it's like they don't even recognize it's violence because it's like, it's just what happens. Like people just, you know, people just like hurt each other all the time. Whether it's like subtle, you know, racism or it's like direct sexual abuse. So I'm just wondering if you could speak to that, like just, you know, how did you in your artistry play with the notion, this how you normalized violence and, you know, like wove it into your novel and your memoir and your collection of essays. Oh, sorry.
I'll give it a shot.
Okay.
So I feel like, you know,
one of the reasons why it took me a long time to kind of come back to this story was that, you know, it wasn't very polite of me to talk about racism or misogyny or being invisible or being othered in America. You know, it's not very polite of me. I've had many workshop leaders over the years be like, well, why are you writing this? You know, this is not appropriate for someone of your, and then it's a backhanded slap, you know, it's like, this isn't appropriate for someone of your intellect, you know, and I was like, well, yeah, but this is the story I want to write. So I had to really let go of, you know, getting permission. Claudia Rankine came out with Citizen, and I was like, here's my permission slip. I get to write about it now because somebody just broke the trail for me, and I get to follow. And you know, people have asked me to describe this novel, and I'm like, it's right at the intersection of House on Mango Street and Citizen, because, and then I want to break that silence, because I already know what the answer is if I don't say anything. It's going to be just the way it is right now, right? And that's not helping anyone, right? And I feel like I especially got vocal once I realized that it's also happening. The stuff that happened to me as a kid is happening now. It hasn't really changed much, even though it's, you know, we're told how much better it is right now. But I don't actually believe that. I think it's pretty much the same. And I have children, and I'm like, you know, I don't want this for them. I want there to be candid conversation. And I know, like, people, you know, they saw the title of the book and they're like, oh, you wrote a political novel. And I'm like, no, I actually didn't. But then again, if you write about racism and misogyny in America, you are actually writing a political novel. Okay, then I did. And I'm hoping that it just starts a candid conversation for change, you know.
So I'm writing an essay right now, and I know this isn't your question, but that's how I'm going to answer it anyway.
No, you can always answer
it
your own way.
I'm writing an essay right now about domestic violence and how, and I guess that my thesis is how domestic violence is a form of terrorism. Right, and a much more pervasive one than the one we think about terrorism. Right, we think of terrorism as the kind of, you know, the, you know, I think all of our consciousness is circulates around like the spectacle of like the and horror of the World Trade Center or of suicide bombings or things like that that we can all sort of see in public. But in 2017, 95 people lost their lives due to terror attacks, and 70 of those were committed by white men. But in 2017, 1,800 women were murdered by their intimate partners. But we don't think about that as like a greater threat. We think about the threat of violence as something that comes from over there rather than something that comes from within our own homes. And really the second leading cause of death for women is their intimate partners. But it's hidden under a veil of like privacy, because, you know, there's still this idea that domestic violence is a private matter, even though there's a clear link between men who abuse their intimate partners and men who then later commit acts of terrorism. Adam Lanza, you know, who shot all the children in the elementary school, first murdered his mother in her bed. Stephen Paddock, who killed 49 people in a concert at Las Vegas, had a history of berating his girlfriend in public. And that's what he did in public, of course. So, like, who even knows what happened behind closed doors? The guy who killed the people at the in the church in Texas had been dismissed from the military for beating his stepson and his wife, and had tied up, you know, and it was really a domestic dispute. He was looking for his mother-in-law at the church. And so there's this, you know, link that we don't think of, but between this idea of private violence and this idea of public violence. And I bring this up because the thing that makes private violence possible for women is the thing that makes private violence possible for everyone, right? The same functions that keep a veil over the violence that happens to women and men too, to be clear, the kind of violence that happens behind closed doors in intimate partner relationships, and what keeps that covered is the same function or is the same force that keeps racial violence covered and ecological violence covered, and in many ways the sort of in this country in particular, there's a way in which any power is equated with cruelty and with force, that it's always power over rather than power to. And so thinking about, like, I think of my job very much as like showing not just the violence that's occurring, but also the veil. Like, how do you show the veil, the function of it, and how it works? And that for me is just one of the problems that I continue to come back to. Like, how do I show not just the thing that's hidden, but how it is hidden and the hiddenness itself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's beautiful.
I just want to think about permission a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've given myself permission to do more in the last 2 years is revisit work that sort of gives me a framework I didn't have before. And I think a lot of us do this, most people I know do this with music, like we listen to our favorite songs over and over again. But for example, I was lucky enough to read both of these books before they came out. And I was just wild, not just as like a literary person, but my body was wild. And I think I needed to give myself permission to read and to reread. And you know, one way is that you teach I teach this work. But also, I just always feel with my students, I need to give them permission outside of the classroom to read and read and revisit and revisit and revisit the work that you feel makes you better at being human. You know, and that's like so simplistic, but it's something that I needed to give myself permission to do. And you know, both of these books, for y'all who have them and those of you who don't, like, these are incredible books to read and to reread and reread as literary citizens, but also just as human beings, right? Because they give you frameworks and they keep you attentive in ways that I wasn't attentive before. And it's, you know, sad that as a writer I have to say that I had to give myself permission to reread and reread and reread. But I did. Yeah.
Thank you. So just one more question before we open it up to everyone. It's really light. It doesn't have anything to do with writing, because y'all are human. So, you know, just what brings you joy? Just tell us one thing that brings you some joy in this world.
I'm going to be honest, you know.
I hope so.
I just like, I mean, some people in the room will know what I mean when I say this, and some people not, and I'm not going to explain it for people who don't, but like, I just love ignorant shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you ask them the truth is like, I love like the most ridiculous, non-harmful, ignorant shit. Like, I like being around people who say ignorant shit. I like people who encourage me to say ignorant shit. And especially now that I'm a public person, I just like, I was with my father here this weekend. You know, my father and I didn't grow up together. And, you know, we spent the weekend doing lots of stuff, but we also just spent the weekend like saying like lots of ignorant shit to each other. And touching and smiling. And so like, I just love, adore ignorant shit.
Oh, yeah. Best. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, I don't know what to say after that. I will say, like, I, one of the things I really love doing these days is we rescued a puppy about a year ago, and I think the happiest moment every day is when I get to walk her and just take a deep breath and look around. Mm. Yeah, and just be present. Be present, yeah.
I mean, as I said before, like, running, swimming, feeling my body moving through the world, but also, like, ranch dressing. And chicken wings, and, you know, just, like, just trying to, like, bring myself pleasure, like physical pleasure that doesn't necessarily, and I don't mean sexual pleasure necessarily, though that's good too, but also just anything, like, you know, when there's like a cool breeze and being outside and laughing with my friends, and later I'm gonna sing really badly at karaoke and I'm gonna laugh really hard, and just sort of being present in community and being surrounded by people I love.
Thank you. So we wanted to spend a little time opening it up to questions, and I see a hand in the back there, so I'm going to shout your question.
I'd love to.
Is that Aya?
It is.
Hi, Aya.
So this has been a fabulous panel, and my question is, I guess you can't say, but everybody, in the project of ending patriarchy, it seems like one of the big strategies within patriarchy is convincing men who have been harmed by a...
I don't really need it. In the project of ending patriarchy, one of the strategies that the patriarchy has is convincing men that they've been harmed by women, that women are harming them. And it goes to what you said, Lacey, that there's some place that that gives them permission to act out the hurt that actually comes from the bigger system on women. And I think about, you know, these sort of men's rights activist type guys and groups who have their finger on the harm, but then where they go with it is within the patriarchy, right? So I just would love to know, like, particularly because your book speaks in a way that I've never heard articulated before about men's experience of trauma and harm, particularly black men and the body, and sexual trauma and heaviness. Where do you think that fits, if you think, in this larger project of helping men identify the system as harmful to potentially get them on board to taking the system down?
I love you, remaining.
Most of the men that I talk to about cis hetero patriarchy are black men, and for, you know, most of the brothers I'm talking to, sometimes it's reductive, but it's easier for us to think about the ways that most black folk I know understand that white supremacy necessarily ravages white folk, right? Internally, especially. And, like, and I think we bodily have to deal with that, and we have to deal with it psychologically too. But, like, I always start there. And also I start from the place of saying that I'm not, again, like, I'm, because I'm talking with people or talking with young men or talking with older men about patriarchy, cis hetero patriarchy, it doesn't mean that, like, I have transcended that shit, right? Like, it is a system in which, like, it infects us, and we invest in it every single day. But I think once you really, you know, people always are like, you know, KSA, what do you think you can do to make black men be more vulnerable? And I just think often we just have to turn to questions, because I don't know a black man who isn't extremely insecure, extremely vulnerable. But, like, extreme insecurity and extreme vulnerability don't mean that we are contending with that extreme insecurity or vulnerability. And part of what I'm trying to do in my own life is think about how the articulation, the wrestling with the violences that we do to ourselves and that we do to our partners is also tied to the violences that often comes from parents. And what a lot of men I don't want to do is blame, like, the one parent, right, the mama, for fucking them up. And then we see, like, an extension of that blame, I think, often landing on the bodies of their partners, who often happen to be women, right? So I just try to talk honestly about the ways that I've not just failed myself and my body, but the ways I've failed particularly femmes and women who I purported to love. But the main thing is what you said. I mean, the answer is in your question. Like, patriarchy is fucking up everybody up in this room. You know what I'm saying? White supremacy is fucking up every single human being in this room. And I would argue that it's fucking up white folks way more, because I think the interiority is much more important than the exterior, right? And I think the same thing goes for, cis hetero patriarchy. Like we are fucking women up at rates that like we can't even fucking count, which means we are being fucked up by the system. But like, unless you articulate it and talk about it, but then this is a bigger question that has to deal with education. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I wasn't taught how to wrestle with that shit. I wasn't taught how to think about like masculinity is something that actually could be contended with. So if it ain't happening in schools, it ain't happening in churches, it ain't happening in therapy, because most folks ain't going to therapy, it ain't happening in families, what do we do? Do you know what I mean? And I think you actually have better answers to that question than I do, because you're smarter than I am. But that's what I do. And then again, but this is mainly conversations I'm having with black men. And sadly, the way that I can get black men off and understand where we might need to go is by talking about the ways that we all kind of sort of see, regardless of educational attainment, the way white supremacy is fucking up white people. And once they nod their heads to that, you got to be like, well, yeah, don't you see the way patriarchy is fucking us up too? And sometimes you get a head nod, and sometimes you get a, you know. But that's better. That, you know, I mean, small. Yeah, so that's where I am with it.
Is there another question?
Is another question out there? Yeah.
I'm just curious whether, I'm so sorry, I don't know all your backgrounds, but I read, Lacey, that you have a PhD, and what I'm wondering is, writing about trauma is difficult enough, but writing in and of itself is very, very hard, and I'm wondering if graduate school or a PhD, I don't know, I'm sorry, I don't have my glasses, if you guys were in grad school, if that helped you to feel like, yes, I can write my message and put it into a book form and get it out there. And particularly, Lacey, I wanted to ask, if you hadn't gotten your PhD, would you have written the books?
Yes. I think a lot of people go to grad school looking for permission to write their story. And the only person who can give you permission is yourself. There are certain things that I got from grad school that I'm glad that I got. You know, I got to, you know, I gained a community of writers who are still my community. It's great to see them like moving in big ways through, you know, big ways through the world. I got access to, you know, philosophy and sort of like some hand holding working through that stuff, which is, you know, kind of impossible to read. And sort of it helped me learn how to learn. And so that I think was helpful. But I did not learn how to write in grad school. I don't think I learned how to write until I was out of grad school. And the thing that taught me how to write was writing. Like, writing taught me how to write. There's nothing about writing any of these books that's taught me or prepared me to write the next one that's gonna come. It's just the like sitting down, putting your butt in the chair, and like learning as you go. But I don't think that that grad school was the thing. Having the credentials and being able to have a teaching job and stuff like that's nice, but I don't think that it was the prerequisite for being a writer by any stretch of the imagination at all.
Yeah, I would echo that. I have graduate degrees. I have a couple, but none of them were helpful for writing. But what I did get, like the gift I got from grad school is my community. And especially, you know, my core group of friends that I got, they've been wonderful, and they've stuck by me and they've helped me. And that is invaluable. But I didn't actually learn how to write. I thought, yeah, it's just like Lacey said, I figured out how to write this book as I was writing it. So, yeah.
It helped me accumulate a lot of debt.
Oh, yeah.
But that was about it.
Now we're going to pay
Any other questions out there? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I did learn how to write fiction in grad school because I'd never written fiction before. Do you know what I'm saying? But I was writing essays in undergrad, and then I wrote one story and got into Indiana. And the thing that really did help me tie to community is that Shannon Gibney was in my workshop. Dana Johnson, Abner was in my, you know, like there were, so most of my workshop was actually folks of color. And so like I was writing these fictional stories to people of color. And that's a big deal for a lot of people in workshops, because most black folks I know, for example, in workshops are not writing directly to folks of color. And so writing to people who sort of understood and sort of didn't understand where I was coming from sort of just helped me hone my fictional craft. It didn't help me at all with essays. It might help me how to create scenes and whatnot, but I didn't know how to write fiction at all. I didn't have a clue. So it, I learned a lot in grad school because of my community, not because of my teachers.
Thank you.
Thank you for everything that you've said today. I'm wondering, the word that irks me the most in relating to trauma is closure. There's no such thing as closure. You create a new way. Do you feel that way, or how do you interpret that?
What do you think about closure?
That there is no closure. I think you're right. You know, I feel like I've changed, and so I'm moving on, but I haven't put anything to bed. You know, there's just no closure. You just learn to live with it, and it becomes less and less of a priority in your life, and then it has a place, but it's always there. And so I applaud people who are able to say, yeah, I was able to, you know, there was some catharsis and I feel better. But I'm not one of those people. Yeah.
I also don't believe, I mean, I don't know, I don't believe them. Like, I think there have been times in my life when I, like, have written something, I'm like, oh, I feel so much better. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you know, a couple weeks later, I'm like, no, I'm not, I'm still not good.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I grew up on a farm, and the metaphor that I like is, like, when a barbed wire fence, like, comes in contact with a tree, like, and it you know, scrapes away the bark and it injures the tree, and eventually the tree like grows around the barbed wire and it becomes part of the tree. And the tree goes on living with this, you know, barbed wire fence like running through the, you know, its interior. And I think of it kind of like that. Like you just sort of grow around this thing and you enclose it, but there's no closure for it.
I agree.
Yeah. I agree. No such thing as closure. It's a check. It's a wrap on that one. Anyone else have a question?
And just so you know, we have about 6 minutes left.
6 minutes.
Thank you for all of you for being so generous and vulnerable. Do you have any guidance or rules of thumb about supporting other people through trauma, or like as they're trying to navigate active trauma? Especially if you know that they've already been traumatized before. I don't know if that makes sense, but.
So the question is, how do you support other people through trauma that might be active while you're working through?
I can tell that my friend is being actively re-traumatized, and the ways in which she's trying to act on that. We're trying to navigate grad school, basically. I don't know if she's gonna make it through grad school if she keeps trying to destroy grad school. If that kind of makes sense.
I feel like you're the person to answer this, actually.
Me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. I think it's a question for the panel. I guess all I would say is that we can't make anybody do anything. That all we can do is be there and support them in whatever process that they're going through. It's like we're sort of the agency is us really being the authorities of our lives and our own experiences, and if we can just be there for them in whatever realm that they're in, you know, I think that's helpful. I did an MFA, and it was horrible and traumatizing, and I, you know, it took me years after it was over to actually I quit, you know, because it was so horrible, And I hadn't been able to pick up, any sort of, it was a MFA, so it was sort of painting and filmmaking. Hadn't been able to pick anything up because I was always like, deconstructing myself, So, hopefully, it took years before kind of recognition that I kind of had, I knew what I was doing again. And I think that sometimes grad school has sadly a tendency to sometimes destroy people's process. But at the same time teach amazing skills. And it's only after sort of years later for me that I figured out how to integrate like the skills, with what wasn't working. But that, I mean, that's my response. What about you guys? You guys teach, don't you?
I mean,
you can.
I just want to say, before we were all writers, and we are all writers, right? Because it doesn't matter. It being published, being unpublished, it's pretty much the same thing. We're all writers. Before we were all writers, we all love to read, right? And so we all have good taste in terms of we really know what we like. We know what gives us pleasure when we read. So we, I find that when I am down in the world, and nothing is working for me, I can always go to a good book and reread, as Kiese said, right? And just reread a good book that we know will lift our spirits and bring us a little joy, right? And that's, it's not retreating, it's sort of re-energizing, right?
Thanks. So I just, I think maybe I might take the last few minutes to do some closure of the sense of, so we've been, oh dear, just put my foot in my mouth. Just in terms of the arc of this conversation, just want to give, each of you a chance just to say something for the next couple of minutes about anything that we talked about, just to sort of close out this panel. Or would you rather just take a question? Oh, there's a question up there. Never mind. Forget what I said.
Thank you. Each of you talked about resilience in your own way, and I love the question of what gives you joy. So, I'm writing a very traumatic memoir, and I'm looking for that lack of abundance. I'm looking for that thing that on which my own survival hinged. And sometimes I look back and say, how am I here? So I wonder if you guys could, Kiese, particularly because I just read your book, if you want to talk about it, but all of you,
resilience. Oh, resilience.
Okay. I just think it's about the minutia, like the creases of the people who made you. My grandmother is super, super sick. She's shrinking. And for me, in order to write this book, I had to think about her body as a thick body, right? And what it meant for her to actually shrink, not just in size, but actually in voice too. And that meant I needed to not just think about all the triumphant shit she did, working in a chicken plant, working for white people and whatnot. But for me, the scene that really was the anchor of this book that didn't make it into the book was my grandmama coming home from the chicken plant at the end of the day, chicken debris and shit all over her outfit, which was still immaculate because she was fresh to death, right? Which is important, right, for the memory. And then she just wanted to watch Wheel of Fortune because the night before, a black person had won. And she wanted to see that black person win again. And after a day of working, that brought my grandmama joy. That's weird, but I think all of our lives are filled with these weird idiosyncratic things, And for me, a lot of it does have to do with southernness and blackness and sometimes queerness and femininity and whatnot. But I think everybody has those stories. But the creases, the untold stories that only you or I or anybody in this room can tell, I think are what are gonna make that book sing. You know what I'm saying? The creases of the shit, not just the blobby stuff anybody can tell. And for me, the creases have to do often with joy and with humor. And joy and humor are always tied to trauma.
Thank you. Either of you wanna?
Yeah, I guess I think that, there's a way that you as Kiese was pointing out, that you are observing that it's not a sort of flat surface, the thing that you are writing about, but also you don't have to be a flat surface either, and you don't have to like have your chair, you know, have your butt in the chair like all the time and do it like, and because at a certain point it feels self-harming, right? That there are ways that you can and must take care of yourself while you're doing that work, and not just, you know, go for a walk and things like that, but do things that like are fun and make you laugh, and you know, watching comedy and being with your girlfriends and like you know, singing bad karaoke and eating ranch dressing and like all the things that are just like make you feel good. And just like trying to spend as much time as you can in that place of feeling good, so that you can maintain. It's not. I don't know if I like the word resilience, and I, not to knock your word or anything, but so like in the discourse, thinking about it, because I think it's more like stamina and stubbornness and like determination, rather than like being able to come back. It's not like bouncing back. It's like. Like just continue, like you get knocked down and you just, you know, keep slogging through, and that has I think everything to do with stamina and determination and stubbornness, and sometimes with rage and anger and fury, and so to balance that out, I feel like I have to also try to make myself feel good sometimes too.
All right.
Thank you.
Do we have time for a yes and no question really fast?
We don't have time, unfortunately. All right. But what we do have time for is that these folks will be upstairs. They have their books available and for signing as well. So I just want to thank you all very much, and thank you all very much for coming today. And also, this panel was sponsored by the California Institute of Integral Studies, so thank you, Lisa, who's sitting out there to make it happen. And thanks, folks.
Thank you.
Yep, bye-bye.
Thank you, Sonia.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.